We spend a lot of time on this show talking about the United States Constitution. So much time, in fact, that sometimes we forget that there are 50 states within our federal union, and that each one of those 50 states has its own constitution, and that just like our national constitution, the state constitutions can be amended. They can even be thrown out from time to time, changed entirely. In fact, amendments are far more frequent on the state level than they are on the national level. And so it is with our local state, the state where we're produced, the state of Tennessee. There are actually four constitutional amendments on this fall's ballot coming up here very, very shortly on November the 4th, 2014. And one of them concerns a subject we spend a lot of time on, the judiciary. It's called Amendment 2, and it's going to fundamentally affect how Tennessee's appellate judges are selected. It's a weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and it's all about Tennessee's Amendment 2.
You're listening to your weekly constitutional, underwritten by James Madison's Montpelier. Your host is Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in Grundy, Virginia.
If you're a regular listener, you recall that I've done a number of shows that have talked about judges and judging and the federal and state judiciaries. We've talked to a local federal judge, a local state judge, even the Chief Justice of the Tennessee Supreme Court. And it was during those discussions, it was during those interviews that I learned that the state of Tennessee, where this show is produced, is facing a number of constitutional amendments this fall. And one of them, Amendment 2, will fundamentally affect how appellate judges in the state of Tennessee are selected. It turns out there's quite an ongoing controversy about whether the current system, which involves a gubernatorial appointment and then a so-called retention election, whether that system is in fact constitutional or not. So I invited Herbert Slattery, who at that time was the counsel to the governor, to Governor Haslam, to come in and tell me about this. Interestingly enough, Mr. Slattery has been selected in the meantime. Since that interview, he's been selected as the new attorney general in the state of Tennessee. So I guess he knows what he's talking about. But he was here to support Amendment 2. And I thought it was also fair to hear from people who oppose Amendment 2. So after we hear from Mr. Slattery, we're going to hear from Frank Daniels, who is a columnist for the Tennessean newspaper in Nashville, and who's going to give us the other side. But first, Herbert Slattery, the new Attorney General of the state of Tennessee.
I'm Herbert Slattery. My official title is Counsel to the Governor, and it basically means I'm Governor Bill Haslam's attorney.
You're the top attorney in the state of Tennessee.
Well, I don't know that I'm top, but I am an attorney for him. I'd say probably the top attorney in Tennessee might be the attorney general.
Okay, that's right. Okay, the attorney general's also. Is attorney general in Tennessee elected or appointed?
It's appointed. Actually, Tennessee's got a rather unique way of getting to the attorney general. The Supreme Court appoints the attorney general.
I knew that. I just spoke to Gary Wade, the chief justice, a couple of weeks ago, and he and I talked about that.
It's really an unusual process, but it's a process that we've grown to like. There's an independence to the attorney general that Tennessee has that other states don't have. And so that takes it out of the political realm and creates a degree of independence. You know, if the legislature's requesting an opinion, he gives them a straight opinion. If we're requesting an opinion, he gives us a straight opinion, and we don't really have any, quote, control over him. He just tells you what the law is.
Very interesting. Okay.
Well, and by the way, he's really good. Bob Cooper's his name.
Bob Cooper. Mm-hmm. Well, you've given your tip of the hat to Bob Cooper, and you're being very modest, but it's fair to say that you are at least the governor's top lawyer.
That's right.
Okay. So you are the legal right-hand man to the governor of the state of Tennessee, Bill Haslam. First, I want to know, how do you get a cool job like that? I mean, that every lawyer who's listening, and we have a lot of lawyers listening, say, how do I get Herbert's job?
I've known the governor for more years than I want to acknowledge, but so he's been a close friend. He had two terms as mayor, and the second term, I told him, I said, if I can help you in, whatever else you do after this, I'd really be interested in doing that. So he called me one day and asked me to if I'd be interested in being a treasurer for his campaign. I said, sure. And
That's a tough job.
It ended up being almost a full-time job, which I really liked. It was really different. But I'm convinced that he didn't really know what he was asking me to do, and I didn't know what I was volunteering to do.
Before you get to the campaign, what did you do before that? Were you in private practice?
I was in private practice. I was a senior partner with a firm, Edgerton McAfee, Armistead and Davis in Knoxville.
Mm-hmm.
For 30 years.
Wow.
I was in one firm, rather unusual story, but it's an old line firm founded in 1933, basically a business commercial litigation firm.
So you were basically in private practice in Knoxville for a number of years. Go back a long time with the governor. He asked you to help with campaign, so you helped, and you were about to tell me how that went.
We raised a good bit of money and wrote a lot of checks, and then he won with a very sizable victory.
What year was this?
This was 2010 is the election, and he took office in January of 2011.
Okay, so he's in his first term.
He is in his first term and running for re-election in November of this year.
Oh, this year. Okay, mm-hmm. So he's going for a second term.
Yeah, second term.
Are you also going to help out, or can you help out with his campaign this year?
No, I really can't. I need to be doing the job that I've got right now, and he's got a separate campaign running with some really great folks doing that, so...
Okay, so you work well together, you raise lots of money, he's the governor, that's tremendous, and so then one day he gives you a call, I'm guessing.
Well, we talked, and for, I guess, you know, you practice 30 years and you're one in one place. I was really very happy, I felt like a very good practice, but there was a little bit of restlessness and sort of wanting to do something different, so we chatted some, and one thing led to another, and he asked me if I would be interested in coming to Nashville with him, so... I went back and asked the most important person, who is my wife.
Of course.
And
hi, honey.
She was excited about doing it. So
we
signed up. She really was.
Didn't mind moving from Knoxville to Nashville?
She's got quite an adventuresome spirit, and she was all in from the get-go.
Well, that's just marvelous. So you took office then shortly after the governor did, I guess, in 2011?
Right.
And you've been
January 15th, 2011.
So then you've been doing this for 3 years?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now we get to the question I was going to ask you a moment ago. So why in the world are you gracing us with your presence? Why did you drive all the way to Johnson City from Nashville today, for which, incidentally, we thank you very much. What brings you here?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on. Well, one of the major initiatives this year that the governor's taken on is a constitutional amendment on how we select judges in Tennessee, and that's going to be on the ballot in November. And it's one of those issues that's so foundational and so important that I'm afraid people will miss it. It may be the most important judicial issue in my lifetime.
Well, you and I both know something, Herbert, and that is that issues that are important, especially when they involve judiciary and judicial elections,
mm-hmm.
I know this isn't exactly what that is, or constitutional ballot amendment,
right.
Sometimes those are the ones that get lost in the shuffle. They really do. I mean, people are focused on the president in a presidential year, or their members of Congress or the Senate in those races, but they ignore these important state issues. So I'm very glad, just from an educational and informational viewpoint, that you're on telling us about this. So what is going on with us?
In Tennessee, we've actually for about 20 years, we've been asking this question, which I found it surprising, but it's basically, do the judges of the Tennessee Supreme Court and the other appellate courts constitutionally hold their office? And we've had something like probably 10 lawsuits on the issue.
Are saying that your judges are unconstitutional.
Yes.
Explain this to me. What's going on?
Well, Article 6, Section 3 of the Tennessee Constitution says that the judges of the Supreme Court will be elected by the qualified voters of the state. And in Tennessee, the election, and three Supreme Court opinions have upheld this, is a up or down retention election, which is a yes-no vote. So they're not running against a candidate. And but there are a number of people that read those words, elected by the qualified voters of the state, and immediately think of it needs to be a contested election with another candidate, and you know, you go back and forth like you would if you're a legislative office or executive office.
Okay, let me just make sure I understand this. The Constitution of the state of Tennessee says that judicial officers are selected by qualified voters.
Right.
But it doesn't specify exactly what type of election is held. Now, you might think, well, that means contested elections. That's mm-hmm. how things are done. Well, that's mm-hmm. only one way. In fact, many judicial elections in many states are retention. You're
correct.
Appointed originally, and then it's simply, should we keep this judge, yes or no? So that's actually a very common alternative style of election in judicial elections, and that's what Tennessee's chosen, but there's some vagueness under the Constitution as to whether that is, in fact, constitutional.
Right, and so we have— lawsuits that have been filed on it. You know, maybe 10 lawsuits have been filed on it over the years. We've spent no telling how much money defending those.
What have they decided, if anything, up to this
Well, point? The three Supreme Court opinions have said upheld the current system of retention elections.
Well, excuse me, doesn't one opinion typically suffice when it's your state Supreme Court?
You would think so. But because of the language, we see, bills brought in the legislature for popular contested, partisan contested elections. And so Governor Haslam, it's been back and forth. So Governor Haslam in 2012 said, you know, this is not a question we should be asking ourselves, whether they are constitutionally seated. Let's answer this one. And so we worked with the legislature and the legislative leaders, and they've been great. And we formed this amendment, got it passed in two general assemblies, and it's going to be on the ballot. But it's,
before
it
we go any further,
everything.
You've got Republicans controlling both houses, right?
Correct.
At this stage, well, I guess if there's a time for a constitutional amendment, it's when you've got one party controlling pretty much both the legislature and the executive. So I can see how that might happen politically.
Right. But you know, interestingly, this is a really bipartisan issue.
So oh, sure. I'm not.
They're Republicans
it isn't.
And Democrats.
It's just
and,
helpful.
Yeah, it's just it is helpful because in Tennessee, you have the first vote, it's a majority vote in each house, and then the next year it's got to be 2/3 or more, so that's a high threshold to hit. So
you've already gone through the Tennessee constitutional requirement of two passages with, in the second one, a supermajority passage.
That's right.
You obviously have a lot of support.
Yeah, and
there.
It passed 29-2 in the Senate and 78-14 in the House on the second time around. So it's got some significant momentum behind it, and the legislature wants to answer this. I mean, there are a lot of important issues out there, but we shouldn't be talking about whether our highest judges are constitutionally seated. I mean, that'd be like you and I sitting at a coffee table and talking and saying, well, Justice Scalia or Justice Alito or Justice Ginsburg, their opinions don't matter because, they don't really constitutionally hold their seats. They weren't confirmed right or whatever.
It tends to undercut the rule of law, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's foundational, and I'm thinking, why are we having that kind of conversation? You know, we can talk about are judges biased or is this opinion right or is their holding correct? All those things are fairly legitimate for sure, but Tennessee, it's not Tennessee to be asking a foundational constitutional question like this. So we want to get it answered. We want to get it answered in November. And we think this is a great answer.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Herbert Slatery, formerly the counsel to Governor Haslam of the state of Tennessee, currently the Attorney General of the state of Tennessee, who is speaking in favor of a proposed Amendment 2 to the Tennessee Constitution. Never fear, though. We're going to hear from the other side as well a little later on in the show. Stick around. Doug Smith, I must say I'm disappointed because I was looking forward to seeing you in your green Riddler tights today, but you're just showing up in your regular garb, so I guess that means we're having a regular quiz question.
I'm sorry to disappoint you.
I know, you look so good in green.
Oh, thank you. It's the mask.
Yes. Tremendous. Well, you've got a regular quiz question for us today. Multiple choice?
I do. It's a multiple choice for four choices.
Four choices. Do we have a contestant?
Yes.
Well, who are you, Ms. Contestant?
My name is Morgan.
Where are you from, Morgan?
Kingsport, Tennessee.
Kingsport, Tennessee. That is a fine, fine place. I've spent many a happy day in Kingsport.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's lovely. And how's the weather there?
I'm sure it's raining there, too.
Oh, okay.
It's been grungy.
Oh, okay. I understand. All right, Doug, what do you got?
Okay, here's the question.
Okay.
What part of the Constitution allows government to acquire property within the eminent domain?
Oh, man.
What part of the Constitution allows government to acquire property within the eminent domain? Is it A, the utility clause? B, I plead the fifth. C, Article 7's land enhancement clause.
Mm.
Or D, the Mars rule.
The Mars rule. Oh, my gosh. Okay.
Let me read those options again.
Start from the beginning. This is a tough question.
So this is an eminent domain question. What part of the Constitution allows government to acquire property within the eminent domain? Is it A, the utility clause? B, I plead the fifth? C, Article 7's land enhancement clause? Or is it D, the Mars rule?
Well, I'm going to have to say I plead the fifth, because I believe that means you're referring to the Fifth Amendment. I plead the fifth.
I think she doesn't want to incriminate herself. That's what this is really about.
What's in the Fifth Amendment that makes you want to plead the fifth?
Well, I've learned throughout the years that the weirdest answer is usually the right one.
Impeccable analysis.
I just remember something about it being saying eminent domain. I'm not bringing up anything, any of the other phrases from the other multiple choice questions.
All right. Well, Doug, how did she do?
She did great.
Well done.
Fantastic.
Absolutely.
It's the takings clause.
Yeah.
Nor shall property be taken for public use without just compensation. Of course, it's the just compensation that usually gets people a little frustrated.
It does get people frustrated. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the takings clause is actually, and by the way, congratulations, and send us an email.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Send us an email at ywc@montpelier.org, and we'll send you your pocket constitution and your t-shirt. Send us your size.
Okay.
And we'll send you one that you can wear. But the takings clause is kind of interesting because it doesn't technically create the idea of eminent domain. That's an idea that goes back hundreds of years in Britain.
The Magna Carta.
Exactly. What it does is it creates the idea that if the government exercises this inherent power to take property for public use, it has to compensate you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's typically what happens. The government will say, we need to build a road here. Sorry, your house is in the way, but we're going to take your house. You might not like that, but by and large, the government has the right to take property, and by and large, it's just a matter of wrangling over how much they're going to have to pay you. There are exceptions and there are complexities, but by and large, it's a very broad power.
In the last 25 years, it's really taken quite the center stage in constitutional jurisprudence.
Oh, absolutely. The Kelo decision, I think that was back in 2005, involved a woman who didn't want to give up her house, and the state of Connecticut was taking her house in order to then turn right around and give it to a private developer for what it called urban renewal. And strangely enough, they were allowed to do it. The Supreme Court allowed them to do it. But then a lot of states didn't like that, and so they've restricted it on a state level. But now I'm getting into too much detail. Fascinating stuff. You're very impressive of knowing that the Fifth Amendment is the relevant one. So congratulations.
Thank you.
Absolutely. And thank you, Doug. That was a good riddle.
You bet. Hey, it's the Constitution. I read it for the articles.
And for the amendments.
And the amendments.
All right. It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Herbert Slattery, the Attorney General of the state of Tennessee, who's speaking in favor of the proposed Amendment 2 to the Tennessee Constitution, which will determine the way appellate judges are selected in this state. I spoke to him some weeks ago about this when he was still counsel to the governor, but now he has ascended to the rank of Attorney General. We'll also hear from the opposing side, from Frank Daniels, a columnist for the Tennessean newspaper, after we finish our conversation with Herbert Slattery, who was just about to tell me exactly what Amendment 2 involves.
Well, it's a type of modified federal system. Huh. This is just for appellate judges. There are 29 appellate judges in Tennessee. There are 12 on the Court of Criminal Appeals, 12 on the Court of Appeals, and there are 5 on the Supreme Court. Now, that's just 16% of the judges in Tennessee.
And that's all you're talking
about?
That's
all we're talking about. We're not talking about trial court judges. They'll continue to stand for election like they're going to do in August.
Right. In fact, we were just talking to Judge Seeley here from Johnson City recently. They have contested elections.
They do.
Okay, so for the trial level, I use this term advisedly, the lowest level of the pyramid, though trial judges are extremely important people. They're elected with regular contested elections that look in many respects like any contested election.
That's correct.
But then when you get to the level of your Court of Appeals, or even beyond that, to your level of your Supreme Court, which stands at the top of the pyramid, you're saying you want to change the way those judges and justices are elected.
Right, because those judges are run statewide, and the trial court judges run locally.
And the trial court judges, if they've got contested elections, they haven't been subject to the same constitutional challenges then.
No. And so we're talking about 29 judges and letting the people continue to elect trial judges as they always have, because they're electing the judges before whom they would appear which makes some sense. But the appellate judges run statewide, and so the amendment that's being proposed has basically three legs to it. It's got gubernatorial appointments, so the governor appoints in his discretion. It's got confirmation by the legislature, and then it has retention elections after that appointment.
Okay, so if I want to be a member of the Tennessee Supreme Court, first I have to convince your boss to appoint me.
Correct.
Then I have to convince the Tennessee legislature. Is that both houses or just the Senate to confirm me?
It probably will be both houses, but the provision in the amendment says the legislature is going to set forth the rules and the regulations of how that's going to happen, the
procedure.
Okay,
so there'll be some sort of legislative confirmation.
Next year, hopefully, after this passes,
okay,
that will
so
be addressed.
Now, so I get appointed Chief Justice or to the Supreme Court or to an appellate court. I get confirmed, assuming I get confirmed. Then I'll have a term of, what, 4 years, 6 years?
It's 8 years. It could be shorter if you're appointed for an unexpired term as a result of a death or retirement.
But a maximum of 8 years.
Maximum of 8 years.
So I've got 8 years. I got job security for 8 years. But at the end of that 8 years, I'm going to be subject to a retention election.
Right.
Okay. Now, and that's basically, here's Harris. He wants to stay on the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court. Do you like him or not? Do you think he's done a good job or not? And they can vote me down, in which case the governor would have to start the process over again with someone else.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's fairly three-part, but fairly straightforward and something, you know, again, similar to what we see in a lot of other states.
And what one piece that we think is an improvement over the federal system is that the legislature has agreed to take action within a 60-day period. So you will not see the backlog on judicial confirmations, for instance, that you see on the federal level. So within 60 days, depending on timing, 60 days at the start of the session or 60 days after the appointment, they're going to have to act or the appointment stands.
Oh, okay. So Governor Haslam appoints Harris to the Supreme Court. 60 days go by. The legislature doesn't like Harris, but they don't do anything about it. Well, Harris is on the Supreme Court then because they've missed their chance.
That's right.
Now, why is this such a better way than simply having the current? In fact, how does this really differ from the current system? The current system involves appointments plus retention elections, doesn't it? I guess maybe it's just the confirmation leg?
Well, it is primarily the confirmation leg. The legislature had to decide where they wanted to be involved in the process. Under the current process, under the Tennessee plan, they had been on the front end because they appointed a judicial nominating commission. So they either had to be on the front end or back end, and the back end is a confirmation, and they chose to do the confirmation piece there. So that's the big change. The governor continues to appoint, and which as a leg we wanted obviously to keep because that really facilitates. There's a good process for that, and then the retention election will be in the Constitution, so we won't have these lawsuits or bills or whatever. I mean, that'll be constitutional. If you want to challenge it, bring another amendment.
Well, to some extent, then, this sounds as if you're essentially looking to legitimize or to codify existing practice so that you no longer have that foundational question of whether the judges are legitimately sat. The significant change is moving the legislature's involvement from pre-appointment to post-appointment. And if that's what the legislature wants, and if that's what the governor's willing to do, I guess that's, you know, six and one half dozen of another. You know, they can cite their preferences. But what this really does is legitimizes the idea of gubernatorial appointments plus retention elections.
Right, right.
And so then you would put to rest, one would hope, any challenges to the legitimacy of your appellate judges.
And that's what we really want. We want clarity. We just feel like on that such a fundamental issue as that, we need clarity, and that's why the governor's leading out front. He's actually, it's interesting, we had a couple of weeks ago, we had the launch of the campaign, which is Vote Yes on 2, and there's a website, voteyes2.org, for us. But the governor's leading a campaign. He's the chair. And to show you the bipartisan nature of this, Governor Bredesen,
who was the
previous governor.
His predecessor. He was a Democrat, wasn't he?
He was a Democrat. He's a co-chair. And then Senator Fred Thompson, well,
I remember Fred. How's Fred doing?
He's doing well.
Still driving that pickup?
he is. I think it's interesting. If I can maybe step back a little bit. I met him in the middle of a major piece of legislation and tort reform in Tennessee because he was representing some folks that were opposed to that. And my wife continues to tell me, says, yeah, this is how important you are. We were in a committee, judiciary committee, getting ready to make a proposal. And And so I got up and they introduced me, and you know, I'm counsel with Governor Haslam. And then I had like 10 minutes, and then they turned to Senator Thompson and says, "Now we're going to hear from our beloved Senator Fred Thompson." And they gave him 45 minutes.
Oh, it's hard to compete with a movie star.
And he's every bit what you see, very accomplished, very articulate. We're happy that he's agreed to weigh in on this amendment, because that's something. I mean, he's got plenty of things to do, but it was really important for him that Tennessee fix this. And Governor Bredesen has come out and has been he's been great on it, because he came out and said, you know, "I've been in office or I've been out of office since 2011. I have not weighed in on any particular issues purposefully, because Governor Haslam is a governor and I am not. But there is going to be one issue that I'm going to weigh in on, and it's judicial selection, and I'm weighing in on this one." So
wow.
He's, of all the issues he could pick, he's picking this particular amendment and speaking out on it, and he is as articulate as you would think he would be.
Well, you know, you've identified Democrats, Republicans, celebrities, senators who are all lining up behind us. Is there any organized opposition? Is anyone opposed to it?
Well, we've had a litigant that's been fairly faithful on opposing this, but there's there have been some, you know, in anything important like this, you're going to run into some opposition.
Right.
But we think that this is such a balanced approach that it's going to get some real momentum behind it. And we've got bipartisan, like you said, support.
Well, you got to help me out here, though, Herbert. I need to find somebody else. We always try to be balanced on this show. I need to find somebody from the other side. Who's the most prominent spokesman on the other side for this, so we can send him an email and have a chance to respond to it?
Well, the most vocal one, there's been a writer in the Tennessean, Frank Daniels, is one. So you might.
So he's one of the writers for the Tennessean newspaper.
He's written a few articles on it. Uh-huh.
Well, we'll reach out. At least give him a chance. Just tell us you're all wet. Right. And everybody else that you are.
I understand.
Okay. Well, then it's just the two of us today, let me play devil's advocate.
Okay.
If you're going to be amending the Constitution, and if you've already got successful judicial elections at the trial level, why not just have elections? Why not be democratic? Let's just have elections and elect our judges. Contested elections.
That's a great question. And really, you know, one argument that people throw at us all the time is you're taking away the right to vote.
Sure.
But we're really not, because this amendment, the people are involved at each of the three levels. They elect the governor. If you don't like who the governor's appointing, you know, you don't vote for him. Vote for the other guy. You're going to be electing your senator and representative that's going to be voting for you, and we are in a republic. They're going to be voting for you on the confirmation. And then if those don't work, you know, you've got the retention election. You vote no, and, you know, you just fire them. But
well, that's true. But
so there are three.
But don't forget, most of us don't have as much access to Governor Haslam as you do.
Right.
So, I mean, in a local election, yeah. You know, my vote really does count, because it's just my district, and I maybe know the people.
Right. And you raised a really a good question. And there's a little bit of nuance to it, but think about we just think when you enter a partisan contested election for appellate judges, it's really different. Chief Justice John Roberts said that, you know, they're just umpires. They call balls and strikes. They're not politicians. They can't promise anything. They can't promise they'll vote for anything. They'll decide one way or other. They just can't do that. And if they're on a campaign trail, it's very difficult for them to answer questions. You know, if somebody raises a question and says, "Well, I'll tell you," their opponent says, "Well, I'll tell you what, I would hold differently. This is how I'd answer that question." Well, you know, that case may still be in play. It might be in on appeal or whatever. And the sitting judge, appellate judge, has to be silent. It just doesn't fit that type of campaign. And frankly, one of our concerns is we think if you were to do that, then you're going to see a lot of money flowing into judicial campaigns. And when it does, when that happens, and it becomes much more divided, becomes sharp on the accusations, it really takes the judiciary branch down a notch in terms of respect. And that's a significant loss in the governor's mind.
Yeah, I think, I can't speak for him, but it seems to me fairly consistent with things I've heard from other people. We interviewed Chief Justice Gary Wade recently, and although he was very respectful of the system in Tennessee, he expressed some concern about those issues in judicial elections. We also spoke to former Mississippi Supreme Court Justice Oliver Diaz, whose tale was one that really is sort of shocking about money in judicial elections and the influence that gets thrown, or the influence that people apparently try to buy. Now, of course, we had a very bad circumstance in West Virginia not long ago when our Chief Justice was effectively disqualified from a case by the United States Supreme Court, which never does that because of some, shall we say, extreme appearances of impropriety where it looked as if a mining company had essentially bought a chief justice to get a certain outcome in a certain case.
Yes.
So those are very, very serious issues. And so I guess now I'm not playing devil's advocate, and I'm arguing the point on your side. So let me take it a notch further. You're moving toward what looks kind of like a federal system. Mm-hmm. Not exactly the same. You've already tried to address some of the weaknesses of that. You've got 8-year terms. So to at least some extent, you insulate a justice on the Supreme Court or an appellate judge in Tennessee from political pressure. Why not just go whole hog? Why not adopt a federal system and say you're on, and you're on for good behavior for the rest of your life?
Well, you know, Tennessee started out that way in 1735. They could stay. The legislature appointed them, and then they could stay as long as they had good behavior. We also think in Tennessee there's a degree of accountability there. Mm-hmm. Every 8 years, it's a long 8 years of a long term. Every 8 years, they got to stand and on a record. And I think that degree of that degree of accountability has served Tennessee well over the years. And so we really didn't want to change that. That accountability helps.
Well, in a way, then this is a compromise between straight judicial elections.
Mm-hmm.
And the federal system. You've got a much more federal-type mechanism with some differences on the front end. But then on the back end, you also have sort of an 8-year reset. So if you put someone on there and you don't like him, or at least if enough of the public doesn't like him, then the public can say, made a mistake on that one. Governor, give us a new one to try.
And people change in 8 years. One of the most important things for this governor is we want to appoint not only competent judges of great character, but we want to appoint humble judges. They wield a lot of power.
Are you accusing judges of becoming
They wield a lot of...
Well, who would have thunk that?
They have a lot of power. So so that, if that were ever to come, I'm not saying it ever happened, but if it were to come, then you've got, that year reset.
In theory, if the judge were to get
concept,
then maybe he would be rejected on the basis of insufficient judicial humility.
Right.
Understood. Herbert Slattery, who is the counsel to the governor. Thank you very much for coming all the way down to Johnson City and talking to us about this very, very important constitutional amendment.
Thank you.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I've just had a fascinating discussion with Herbert Slattery, the Attorney General of Tennessee, all about his support of the proposed amendment to the Tennessee Constitution. After the break, we're going to hear from the other side, from Frank Daniels, a columnist at the Tennessean newspaper in Nashville, who doesn't think Amendment 2 is a very good idea. So stick around. It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and now it's time to finish up my discussion with Frank Daniels of the Tennessean newspaper.
Well, Stuart, thanks for having me on your program. I'm Frank Daniels. I'm a columnist with the Tennessean. Have been writing for mostly about politics on the editorial page, and most recently on the news pages for the Tennessean, which is the daily newspaper in Nashville covering Middle Tennessee, where the state capital is.
Right. In fact, I don't think it's too much of a stretch to say you're one of the more prominent political columnists in Tennessee, aren't you?
Well, it's a small group.
Well, you're a modest columnist, so thank you very much for being on here. I was recently speaking to Herbert Slattery. It was actually a few months ago when he was still counsel to the governor, and he came down to Johnson City to advocate for Amendment 2 to the Tennessee Constitution. And of course, as I'm sure you know, he subsequently was appointed by the Supreme Court to be the Attorney General. I don't think that that changes any of his positions on Amendment 2, but just wanted to clarify that this is an older interview that just preceded yours. But during that interview, he identified you as a leading opponent, someone who's opposed to Amendment 2, and suggested that I give you a call for an opposing viewpoint. So I wonder if you'd confirm that and share with us then, if that's true, what makes you oppose this?
Well, Stuart, when I came out of retirement and began writing about politics and looking into what Tennessee's political future might be and really what its past has been, one of the things that struck me was this very tortured way that Tennessee has evolved to select and retain its appellate court judges, a system that was put in place in the early 1970s. Democrats were worried that the Republican voters were going to kick Democrats out, so they decided to create a different way of electing judges. The constitutions of Tennessee, since the first one in 1796 through the one that we currently operate on under, which was adopted in 1870, always had elected all of our judges, and the Constitution does say that under Article 6, Section 3, that the judges of the state shall be elected by the qualified voters of the state. And that just always struck me strange, that we would have the legislature create a political system of appointing and then retaining judges in unopposed elections. The Supreme Court was added to that in 1994. So it just seemed very bizarre to me that Tennessee, a state of true independence and a state that stands for individual liberty, would have adopted a constitutional change without asking the voters to amend their constitution.
Okay.
So that just seemed to me as something that just didn't seem very Tennessean-like to me.
And that system's been challenged a number of times, hasn't it?
It has been challenged a number of times. It was challenged immediately, and the courts have upheld it. You know, you'd have to really wonder. I mean, I've always wondered at the strangeness that the courts would continue to rule, the judges would be continued to rule about a system that they themselves are beneficiaries of.
That's kind of a difficult circumstance, isn't it? I guess the judges are deciding whether they in fact are constitutionally sitting in their seats.
Exactly. And the first time the Supreme Court ruled, subsequently that twice a special court was appointed to deal with that. Of course, on the special court are former judges who also benefited from an appointive system where they did not have to run in a contested election. It just seems disingenuous when everyone says, well, the Supreme Court has upheld the system three separate times. And I think anybody looking at this would say there's more questions than answers when you make that assertion. In fact, Brian Kelsey, the senator from Germantown, wrote a op-ed in the Tennessean last week where he just says the current system is unconstitutional. He's the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and he's the one that proposed Amendment 2. So when everybody knows that the system is unconstitutional and the Supreme Court continues and special courts continue to say it's constitutional, we have very much an emperor and his new clothes situation, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, won't Amendment 2 fix that then? I mean, that's actually, I think, one of the main reason that Herbert Slater, he told me he supports it, because these questions continue to pop up and people are questioning the legitimacy of the judicial rulings upholding it. And so won't this fix all of that?
Well, it certainly Amendment 2 will create a new system. It is not the system that we currently have. The Tennessee plan right now had a judicial nominating commission of citizens that would recommend three separate candidates to be appointed by the governor. The governor would appoint, that person would take a seat, they would have to run in a special election at the next biennial election, then they would have to run for, and that would be a retention election, then they would have to run in a retention election if a judicial performance evaluation commission deemed that they were competent, and then they could run unopposed. Only one judge, Penny White, was ever defeated in a retention election, so it's essentially a rubber stamp process, which caused lots of controversy this summer when Lieutenant Governor Ron Ramsey was trying to unseat several of the current Supreme Court justices. So Amendment 2 actually imposes an entirely different system where the governor would choose the nominating process that he or she so wanted. The governor would nominate, the legislature would confirm, and then an election on the octennial election process, just as we currently have. That is part of the Constitution that would not be changed. Interesting part about this constitutional amendment is it would remove the first sentence of Article 6, Section 3, which says the justices of the Supreme Court shall be elected by the voters, qualified voters of the state. It's a simple statement. It's a straightforward statement. It reflects the fact that the framers of Tennessee's government believe that Tennesseans should judge the people that judge them. Tennessee is a state that has very few statewide elected offices. The Supreme Court, five Supreme Court justices are one of them. The amendment does not fix the fact that right now we're electing the various courts of criminal and appeal statewide instead of within the districts, which I think has been challenged in court. There's a case pending before the Supreme Court. That doesn't make sense either. I mean, Tennessee in the early 70s just started walking down a path that takes power away from the ordinary Tennessean and gives it to a small group of people who have a vested interest in the system. And, you know, we ought to take the power back to the people and have the legislature restore the 1870 provision of how we select the people that judge us.
Okay, so the fundamental objection you have, if I may say so, on sort of a policy level, is that you think that this is not as democratic as you would like it to be, or indeed as you believe the Tennessee Constitution requires it to be. Is that a fair statement?
That very fair statement. I believe that, you know, we either trust the people to vote their conscience and do the responsible activity of being a member of a democracy, or we don't. And I think if we continue to say that people are not responsible, we end up with people that aren't responsible.
Okay, and that's at least identified, that's what Herbert Slattery identified as the primary objection that many people have, is that these retention elections really aren't the sort of elections that you should have in a democratic society. But if I heard you correctly, you also object to the idea that the judicial nominating convention is going to be replaced simply by a gubernatorial appointment followed by ratification by the legislature.
Well, I think that it overcomplicates the system. Before 1970, when judges determined whether they were going to run for office or not run for office, we had perfectly fine judges. The problems in a judiciary have really nothing to do with the system. The governor last week at a presentation with Phil Bredesen, former governor Phil Bredesen, said the same thing. There is no perfect system. It's not the system that gives us good or bad judges. We have good or bad judges because people are good or bad. I happen to think that all systems are going to give us good judges. The nice thing about a popularly elected candidate, someone that is elected by the people and is raising money leaves a trail where a nominating process, we don't know what favors are being traded. It's done in either secret or quasi-secret sessions. And money is not the evil. You know, people are good or bad. I mean, money does present opportunities for evil, but it also leaves a trail where you can go find out if you know somebody is unethical. The canons of judicial ethics protect us and give judges protection when they are in a case where they either have or can be perceived to have conflict of interest. They can recuse themselves. They don't do it often enough. I think judges underestimate the sensitivity of people to perceptions of partiality, of bias, and they should recuse themselves more often. But they don't. They, you know, people think that they have are ethical, and we can understand that. But I think we ought to hold judges, not punish judges for recusing themselves, and let them deal with the same things that we would expect them to deal with if they have a perception of bias in a case, recuse themselves.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned money, Frank, because, of course, that was going to be one of my next questions to you. I guess that means you're just not that concerned about more money flowing into judicial elections.
Well, one of the things that we've seen time and time again, while we bemoan the evils of money, what we find is all these rich people invest all this money and really pay off for them. In the judicial cases, almost every time where they have, quote, bought a judge, unquote, they've been discovered. As a matter of fact, there's a case in Illinois right now, Hale versus State Farm, where State Farm is actually facing RICO charges for trying to put a judge on the Illinois Supreme Court that would vote favorably for State Farm. We don't know where that's going to end up, but that's a great example of its money will tell us about bias and the attempts to purchase judicial decisions where we would not know that in ex parte communication conversations where things happen outside of a courtroom. So I am a great believer that I would rather have money in the process and know where it comes from than to not have money and have everything happen in smoky backfilled rooms, or in, of course, in the modern world, they're not smoky. They just have Starbucks coffee and water.
Well, I guess we really don't know what's in those rooms, smoke or not.
That's true.
That's the whole point. Well, let me ask you a more sort of philosophical question. There are those, certainly among judges and among lawyers, who simply don't think that elections are appropriate. Regular contested elections are appropriate when it comes to electing justices of the Supreme Court or appellate judges, because it's kind of like electing your doctor. You're electing a professional, and really that the voting on something like that should be restricted to perhaps other professionals rather than being thrown out to the public. I'm guessing I know where you stand on that issue, but I think that argument's often made. The public just doesn't have any business voting for judges.
Actually, I have no way to respond to that question. If that's your attitude, you don't want to live in a democracy.
I've actually heard it said, though, we don't vote for doctors. We don't vote for other professionals and that it's just, you know, the sort of reasoned debate that you might desire in a democratic society over the qualifications of judges and perhaps even over their judicial philosophies. There are those who think that that sort of reasoned debate doesn't occur. And that's why there's such a low turnout or a low participation rate for judicial elections. But you're right. It's an anti-democratic argument, isn't it?
Well, certainly there was no low turnout in what turned out to be the most contested, uncontested election that Tennessee's ever seen this past summer, when the retention election, it's hard for me to call a retention election an election, but the retention referendum that occurred had a huge turnout. I think a very educated electorate made the determination, did it their research, and determined that for their own reasons. I mean, certainly I do not agree that those three judges should have been retained, but they decided they did. I'm totally comfortable that that was a reasoned set of choices that voters made. Now, the communication, the conversation in the public airwaves may not have been what some lawyers or those judges would have wanted to call reasoned, but reasoned debate doesn't mean it's you and me chatting like that. I mean, reasoned debate can devolve into some unpretty words and unpretty things, but that is part of political discourse. Now, judges may want to think they're like doctors, but we can't really sue judges when they make a mistake. We have to live with their mistakes. And the only way we can be participating in the fact that they make a mistake is whether we elect them and then whether we have the chance to unelect them. Also, the law is not medicine. It is not science. The law is a constantly evolving understanding of the law. These are not Ten Commandments that we're dealing with.
You mean the law is not holy writ, Frank?
It is not holy writ.
Oh, good heavens. Good heavens.
It is made by people, judged by people, and experienced by people.
All right, then.
None of us are gods.
Well, let's summarize then. If in 30 seconds or less, why should people vote no on Amendment 2?
It won't even take 30 seconds, Stuart. People should vote no because they should retain now and in the future their right to vote. That is the one right that we truly have in a democracy, and we should never give it up.
All right. And if Amendment 2 is defeated, then I'm guessing you would further than like to see the existing Tennessee plan also repealed.
The legislature is going to have to do new legislation anyway. The Judicial Nominating Commission has expired. The Judicial Performance Evaluation Commission has expired. Those have to be reauthorized. So there has to be legislation introduced to even restore the way that Tennessee, the unconstitutional way, that was an editorial comment, the unconstitutional way that the Tennessee has been selecting and retaining its judges. Now, Senator Mike Bell has said that he will introduce legislation to restore the 1870 Constitution, Article 6, Section 3. I've heard that several of the House members would go along with that, may introduce their own legislation. So despite what former Governor Phil Bredesen and others say, that if Amendment 2 is defeated, we're going right back to the way we've done it for the last 40-some years, that's not true. The legislature has to reauthorize what we currently call the Tennessee Plan, or it can authorize something else.
So step one, defeat Amendment 2, and step two, restore the earlier constitutional method of contested elections.
Absolutely. I think that the Judicial Performance Evaluation Commission is a great idea because it does answer the question that many of us have, which is how do we get really good information about the performance of our judges. I would love to see the Judicial Performance Evaluation Commission return so that the citizens of the state have excellent public access to the performance of our judges. But I then think that we should allow people that want to run against those judges to run against those judges.
Well, Frank Daniels of the Tennessean newspaper, thank you very much for your statement of your reasons for wanting to defeat Amendment 2. And I guess we're all going to be watching the polls very soon, next week, actually, to see who wins.
Absolutely. Thank you, Stuart. I appreciate the opportunity to come and talk and look forward to any response that I get from it.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to both sides in this particular debate, to Herbert Slatery, the Attorney General of the state of Tennessee, and to Frank Daniels, the columnist for the Tennessean newspaper. Thanks, gentlemen. This was a very civil and very interesting debate. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineers are Nick Rosa and Bob Hoffman. Our Madison Minute is by the incomparable Jim Blaylock. And our music is by the Watauga Fife and Drum Corps. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.